You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all their lives. For more information, go to www.whiteoakpastures.com.
Fish heads, fish heads, roly poly fish heads, fish heads, fish heads, eat them up, yum.
Hello, welcome back to Catch It, Cook It, and Eat It. I'm your host, Ben Sargent. And today we're talking about a pretty grave matter. That is the oil spill that has occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm sure you all have heard it. I've heard about it. I'm here speaking to an expert on such matters, William Sargent, who happens to be my father, author of Shallow Waters, Year of the Crab, Crab Wars, A Life in the Notch. And he's covered stories on volcanoes, Katrina, the earthquake in Haiti, and specifically the Itak, Mexico oil spill. Mr. Sargent, are you there?
How are you doing, Ben?
How are you?
Good.
Good. fill us in a little, because I think that, you know, what isn't being said is probably what's of most concern. What's the biggest issue that we're dealing with, and why is this potentially more, you know, hazardous than oil spills in the past?
Yeah, I think what everybody's really concerned about, and nobody's saying very much mm-hmm. about it, is that this well should be leaking about 4 million gallons per day of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually only leaking about 200,000 gallons a day right now. The reason for that is that there's sort of a kink in the pipe, and it's just like a garden hose. So it's impeding the flow a little bit. But if that pipe breaks up mm-hmm. and it's deteriorating right now,
right.
you'll get the full flow of 4 million gallons a day. To give you an idea of how much that is,
mm-hmm.
the worst oil spill that we've ever had in this country was from the Exxon Valdez that occurred in 1989. And we would be getting the equivalent of Exxon Valdez every 4 days if this goes to what it has the potential of going
to. And that's if it fully ruptures.
That's if it fully ruptures, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And right now, as far as I understand, there's like 3 leaks. And is it true that they've contained sort of one of them, or they've at least capped it?
Yes, there's one leak. Basically what happened, mm-hmm. you have what's called a blowout preventer, which
right.
is a series of valves that's right on the seabed floor.
Mm-hmm.
And then above that, you have a pipe called the riser.
Right.
And that pipe went about a mile all the way up to the oil rig.
Right.
So what happened is that blowout preventer didn't work for some reason.
And they don't know what the initial explosion was caused by?
They're not really sure. Basically, they had finished drilling this well,
mm-hmm.
and what they were trying to do was put some casing down and some cement. So basically, what they were doing is they would pour concrete down.
Sea bottom.
Exactly, uh-huh. to the sea bottom, and then it was supposed to harden.
I see.
And block it.
Right.
And then this portion of the drilling would be over,
mm-hmm.
and then they would bring another rig in that would actually go into production.
Okay. And the rig on top, as I understand, it blew up, basically. It caught on fire, and then a couple of days later it collapsed, and it brought down essentially the thing that feeds the oil to the surface. Is that right?
Exactly. So
okay.
what you have is you have a whole bunch of twisted pipes
mm-hmm.
that are just sort of sitting on the bottom.
Okay.
And the three remaining leaks are all coming out of little kinks in that pipe.
Right. And why has everything failed in the way of what they normally do in these circumstances?
Well, nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the blowout preventer should have prevented this from happening.
Right.
And the concrete failed. So oil was getting up through that. So you're getting oil and gases. And then that expands as it's going up, and it goes faster and faster, and then it expands and explodes when it came to the surface, and you had that huge fireball that just destroyed the oil rig. And this is a huge oil rig. It's bigger than two football fields.
Sure. And I mean, people have, you know, what, 11 people died.
Exactly.
And, I mean, as horrible and awful as that is, the consequences of the fallout, if I can say that, are like hugely perhaps devastating.
Yeah, it's almost a death blow for that part of the world. I mean, first they got hit with Hurricane Katrina, then Rita, and now everybody's livelihoods is on the line.
And we're talking fishermen. What else? What other business is it?
Well, the fisheries, the whole seafood industry. We get 40% of our seafood comes from the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow!
So you have fishermen, you know, from Louisiana to Alabama, Florida, that whole area are going to be out of work, and that's pretty much the only two industries that you have in that area are, you know, either the oil industry or the fishing industry.
Right, and now they're both shot.
And now they're both shot, exactly.
I was at a restaurant the other day in Far Rockaway, and they were buying up cases of, because all they do there are shrimp and crabs, and that's their entire menu, so they were buying cases and cases because I guess the price will go up so high after this.
Exactly.
Yeah. And are you planning on going down to you're writing about this now currently?
I'm writing about it now, and yes, I have some I have some plans to go down. I don't know exactly when I'll go down. I don't want to be in the way. I want to, you know, get down there and try to help if I can. So I'm just sort of waiting to see how things settle out.
Right. How does this one compare to the Itak Mexico spill?
It's actually quite similar. There you actually had the well was about in 2 miles deep water. This is in about a mile's worth of water. And you had a similar explosion, and it actually caught fire.
Which is a good thing in some ways, right?
In some ways it was, and it burned for several months. And it so at least it was burning off some of the oil.
Right.
And that was just a huge spill. And they did finally put down what they called a Mexican sombrero, which was this huge metal device similar to the containment box that they want to put down on this one. And, of course, this was Red Adair, who's sort of the famous roustabout who has a company, and they specialized in putting out particularly bad oil spills.
And as far as I understand, it's kind of like putting an umbrella over the spill so that you're like almost like it redirecting it up to the surface.
Exactly.
Like, right? So over the three holes, essentially?
I think this is only going to go over the main the main leak.
Okay.
And then the oil will automatically fill up, you know, will rise to the top of that, and then they'll have another drill pipe that will go from the top up to the surface, and so they'll be pumping that oil back up to the surface, and actually, you know, presumably they'll be able to refine that oil and use it afterwards, but it's also a very tricky process because you have almost freezing temperatures a mile down at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. So it's very cold, and they're concerned about actually having ice buildup that would block the oil, and then that could lead to an explosive situation.
Wow.
So what they actually do is then they pipe water down through the outside of the pipe, hot water, to try to keep that, to keep the oil warm.
Moving, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
This is sort of, I guess, your area of expertise more than anything. What is the potential long-term effects of this on sea life?
It's just devastating, totally devastating. You're going to affect you know, the shrimp, the blue crabs, all kinds of species of fish, a lot of mammals. There's actually sperm whales that are in that area, and a lot of dolphins, and of course, you know, dozens of species of birds, some of them endangered species. You know, you could really wipe that area out for several decades. As a matter of fact, there was an oil spill up here in Falmouth, Massachusetts, in 1969, and because it was very close to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a lot of scientists studied it very, very carefully. And they have found that actually that oil stayed in the sediments, you know, for 20 or 30 years. It's almost, it's close to 50 years now. And you can still get the oil is still in the sediments. And so they, you know, it was closed for shellfishing for 20 or 30 years. They've opened it up, but, you know, there's still evidence of oil there.
Yeah, because I was reading some of the reports and they were saying, oh, well, you know, these are such hardy environments and they recover. And I guess what you're saying is even though it may look like they've recovered, it's there. The remnants are there.
Exactly. And yeah. And there's another aspect of that, too. They're using a lot of dispersants to disperse the oil.
Chemicals, yeah.
Chemicals, exactly. And really what they're doing is they're trying to hide what's going on. Because they put the dispersals on, some of them are going on at the right at the seabed. So as the oil is coming out, so some of that oil won't be apparent on the surface. But it's all going to be in the water column. So it's probably doing as much damage, if not more so, in the deep water where we can't see it. But that's where all the fish eggs are.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's just, a like you said, like a preventative press measure, which is, you know, when they see oil-coated birds on the shores, everybody's like up in arms. But what you can't see, it, you know, is happening down below.
Exactly. And that could be, for instance, the bluefin tuna are all breeding down there and laying their eggs right at this time. So there are millions of tuna fish eggs that are in the water. And they'd be very, very susceptible to damage both from the oil and from the dispersants.
And I would imagine all kinds of larvae and eggs and anything would be.
Exactly.
And I mean, what's the, I don't know, in general, who's taking blame for this? Is it BP who's... Because I saw an interview with the CEO, and he said, well, it's not our mistake, but we'll cover the consequences, or something like that.
Yeah.
What does he mean by it wasn't our mistake?
Well, I mean, A, he's legally obligated to cover the to cover the expenses, so that's kind of an easy thing to say. They were leasing the oil rig from a company called Transoceanic, which is a Swiss company.
We hear about them all the time. Why do we, that company? Have they been involved in other cases like this?
Well, this particular rig actually had, it's called the Deep Water Horizon, and it had actually dug the deepest well ever only about a year ago. So it was sort of, you know, top of the line.
I see. So BP comes and they rent the technology, basically.
Exactly.
Even though they kind of own the oil, if you can
exactly
say that.
Okay. Yeah.
And do you think that this is a big enough event that it will put them under?
It's hard to say. You know, oil companies make so much money, and they've got reserves just for this kind of thing. It's going to certainly give them a black eye, and hopefully, you know, it will, you know, improve their practices. In a funny kind of way, I'm kind of optimistic about this. Because it's such a watershed event, you know, some people have called it, you know, our Chernobyl. That I think Obama has the opportunity to really go ahead with a good energy policy and a good environmental policy, and I think the country will, you know, will follow behind him. You know, we've always been willing to do the right thing when it was obvious, you know, what to do.
But it's amazing to me, though, that this happened right after he just opened up Alaska to new drilling.
Yeah, and you know, I think what that was sort of a political sop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it was trying to come up with a bipartisan bill, and I don't think he needed to do that.
Uh-huh.
It included, you know, drilling in a lot of places on the continental shelf,
sure,
off a lot of states. And I don't think anybody's saying drill, baby, drill anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, too, that everybody is sort of, you know, taking part in this. I mean, the fishermen who are now,
yep,
out of work are, in fact, working for BP in a way right now.
Exactly.
They're,
yep,
soaking it up as much as they can because it's their livelihoods. But I kind of,
right,
feel like, I mean, they know the situation. It's not, it's like probably years and years before they'll be able to fish those exact waters.
Exactly.
Right? Hmm.
You know, the Exxon Valdez, what, that occurred in 1989,
mm-hmm,
and that area still hasn't recovered. The fisheries haven't recovered, and the people haven't really recovered.
Hmm.
A lot of them have been also, you know, working for Exxon, you know, with the cleanup and then getting reparations and various things like that. But it's taken a huge sort of psychological toll.
Right.
I think some of the best, the people who reacted in the most healthy way, you know, just said, I can't take this anymore, and they've actually moved out of the community,
mm,
and they're not worrying about, you know, money that they could get for lost fisheries. They're just going on with their lives.
Right. When we come back, Bill, I'm going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I just want to ask you if the fishermen are going to be compensated in any way. Let us take a 2-minute break and don't go anywhere, and we're going to come back and find you.
Right.
Okay.
Out where the river broke, the bloodwood and the desert oak, holding wrecks and boiling diesels, steam at 45 degrees.
The time has come to save this fair, to pay the rent, to pay our share. The time has come, a fact's a fact.
Are back, catch it, cook it, and eat it, and I am talking to none other than my padre about this awful oil spill, which, as we've sort of come to agree on, is maybe a lot worse than anyone's claiming or taking credit for. My question was, Bill, what's going to happen to the fishermen in terms of are they going to be reimbursed for their time that they lose and the fish that they can no longer catch? What happens?
I'm pretty sure they will be. Of course, a lot of them are being to BP's credit, mm-hmm. they hired everybody right away.
Mm-hmm.
All the fishermen who can no longer fish are now out there helping with the cleanup, and mm-hmm. they gave them lessons into how to set out the booms and clean up the birds and everything like that.
The booms, as I understand it, though, are they sort of contain the oil that's on the surface.
Exactly.
But the weather, I guess, has been so bad that they, is that right? That they,
yeah, it is. It sort of breaks them up every night, and they mm-hmm. have to put them out again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a Band-Aid approach.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think the oil is going to come up on the beach.
That hasn't happened yet, fully.
It in spots, it's okay. Starting to happen. Basically, you've got a spill that's the size of Delaware, and it's just floating out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, and corners of it are beginning to wash up on land.
Mm.
But over the next few weeks, even months, the major spill is going to start coming ashore. And then it's going to really be overwhelming, and the booms, will help a little bit, but not that much.
Right. Why, on a larger scale, why do you think we get ourselves into these situations? I mean, everyone knows that we kind of oil has to become a thing of the past. Why
Yep.
is it always like this race for the last little bit that we can soak up?
Well, I think we're totally addicted to oil,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to break an addiction like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much money that's tied up into, I suppose you could continue the analogy. It's a little bit like drug dealers.
Mm.
There's a lot of money to be made in supplying this oil, so everybody can drive wherever they want to.
Yeah.
And so you have to really start breaking down that whole mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm kind of optimistic because I think, we in this one event, we have the possibility of changing everybody's mind. I think
sorry to interrupt you, but don't you think that having an optimistic approach means capping it and solving the solution and then having, potentially we all learn a lesson, but I kind of feel like that never happens. Like in a horrible way, the best thing that would happen is that the thing fully ruptured and then we had no choice, because in every situation like this, it just buys us more time. And instead of coming up with solutions, we just do more of the same.
Yeah. I think that's going to really take leadership from President Obama, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And all the members of Congress, and I think that...
But it was like he was already going in that direction with Alaska, it seemed like.
Yeah, I think he was backpedaling a little
bit. Right,
under pressure from the Republicans,
mm-hmm.
but I think everybody's got to, step back and realize, we've got to stop messing around,
mm-hmm.
and we can't play politics with this,
right?
And we've really got to solve it long term.
Yeah, because the economy, as you said before, when we chatted, the economy depends on, our environment.
absolutely,
yeah.
And we're really losing out to countries like China,
mm-hmm.
and all the European countries that have, taken the steps to move away from oil about 20 years ago.
Hmm.
So they're driving much more efficient cars, they're paying more for their gasoline,
mm-hmm.
and consequently they're way ahead of us in developing wind energy, solar energy, saving on fuel. So we're really becoming a second-rate country.
Right.
The longer we sort of dicker around,
sure.
and don't really take the bull by the horns and do the right thing.
Not to mention the that all those funds or a lot of those funds are going towards countries that despise us.
Absolutely.
This is not really a good situation.
Yeah.
But I mean, as just because I know I cover sort of the catch it, cook it, and eat it. parts to living, I guess.
Right.
Are we going to feel the effects all the way up as far north as we are? Will it contaminate seafood this far up the coast?
There is a concern that it could get out of the Gulf of Mexico. And you could start getting oil, you know, along the eastern beaches of Florida. I'm not sure how far it will get up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it will start to disperse so much that it will become less lethal as it moves out. But simply destroying the fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico is a big enough hit.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's so interesting how these world catastrophes, these events, you know, when it's in the form of an earthquake, it's just like a big boom, and then or a tsunami, and it's just, you know, just everybody's, it's catastrophe, and it hits the news, and it's just, you know, all anyone can talk about. But something like this is on such a larger scale to a degree because of the fallout, but nobody talks about it because it's a slow leak that happens over, you know, first it's days, then it's weeks, then it's months. And it's so sort of anticlimactic, I guess, right? But potentially so bad.
Yeah, and I think with this one, unfortunately, it's going to get worse before it gets better. So it's going to hang around. There's sort of another example of that, and that was, of course, the recent volcano that we had in Iceland. And what happened there is it was big news for about a week, and then pretty much people decided, well, you know, the economy was more important than the environment, and let's get the planes flying again. And as soon as the planes started flying again, that was the end of the story.
Sure.
But in fact, that volcano is still exploding just as powerfully as it had been before.
It's just that we no longer care.
Exactly. Wow. The ash is in the air, and I think it's a very risky experiment that we're doing, because you have, you know, 28,000 flights a day that are flying through these ash clouds, and I'm sure we've already had probably some very, you know, close and encounters, some dangerous situations, and nobody's talking about it.
Right.
But you're really taking innocent people and putting them in danger.
Sure. Now, you've lived in Woods Hole and a lot of places where, like the Oceanographic Institute there, I know they have some of the technology, the robots and stuff that probably they're using in this circumstance. Didn't you have a chance at one point to actually control one of these things?
I did, yeah. It's kind of neat. It's sort of like the ultimate video game.
Yeah.
You have a little control box, and this was in a very deep swimming pool, and you could control it on the bottom. And that's exactly what they're trying to do now.
Mm-hmm.
They have about five little robotic submarines, and these are the ones that they're sending back video, so we know what the situation is down there, and we know where the leaks are. They were also the robots that went into the blowout preventer, and there's a bunch of sort of switches on the blowout preventer. So what they were trying to do, they have these very large arms, and they were trying to switch those switches to close everything off. And for some reason, that wasn't working.
It's amazing. I mean, I envision it like, you know, someone who's trying to, you know, it's like you have no leverage when you're swimming or something.
Exactly.
It's kind of like that, right? I mean, these things are good for minute stuff, but I don't know how they do when you need force involved.
Yeah, I think they could have possibly actually been settling on the bottom, but it's a fairly muddy bottom, so that's certainly a problem.
Right. And then they don't have welding equipment on them. It's not like they can go down and do a patch weld or something of a huge hole, right?
I'm not sure. I mean, that there's some things that they can do. I'm not sure about welding. But, you know, this is such a massive problem. It's great to have the submarines there, but we're seeing that they really can't do that much.
Right. It's so sad how we always learn this the hard way, that, you know, we're not prepared for these events. And they thought that this was one of the most sort of technologically supreme setups that could cut off any problem.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's like the Titanic, you know, it's like the unsinkable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what happens, too, is that we forget very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it almost seems like, you know, we have one of these major spills about every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, the big ones were in 1969 was Santa Barbara, 1979 was Iktok, and 1989 was the Exxon Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it very easy to remember.
Right.
But we tend to, you know, then we forget it. But the good thing that actually happened in each one of these cases is you did have some regulations that were passed. Actually, almost all the environmental regulations that we live with today, things like the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act,
mm-hmm.
all were came about because of the Santa Barbara spill in 1969.
Huh.
And so I think the same sort of thing could happen now.
Right.
The same thing after the Exxon Valdez in 1989, they passed regulations about having double-hulled tankers for transporting the oil.
Okay. What and in the Exxon situation, it was a collision, right? Whereas this is this is like it's a rupture in a pipe.
Yeah.
What are we talking in diameter, like the actual hole that's leaking out?
The pipe itself is only about seven inches in diameter, mm-hmm. which doesn't sound like much.
It doesn't.
But that's, you know, there's a lot of oil that can go through that.
Right.
And, of course, the other problem is you had a finite amount of oil on the Exxon Valdez.
Sure.
So you knew eventually it was going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no.
So this wouldn't dry up on its own for years.
Exactly.
It would just keep going and going.
Yeah. The other thing that they're trying to do, and probably, you know, if there is an answer, this would be the answer,
mm-hmm.
is they're trying to drill a relief well down beside the existing one, and then they have to go into the seabed
mm-hmm.
and find the pipe, and again, it's, you know, 7 inches in diameter, and then drill into the pipe and inject concrete in there to seal the pipe and try to do it that way. But they're talking about a minimum of 3 months to actually get that done.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane, and it's especially aggravating in a place like where I live, which is we actually have had one of the worst oil spills probably ever, and it's been a continual tiny pinprick of a leak that has contaminated most of the waters around New York.
Really?
Yeah, and it's been doing this since the 1970s, and there's no way to shut it off as far as they know. And, you know, it's only in the past couple of years that's come to light, that, you know, this thing, it's just been a trickle, a little trickle. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what's your thinking if you're to go down there? Are you going to, how do you rent a helicopter, or how do you get out to see it?
Well, you know, in a situation like this, people are actually very, very helpful. I like the can-do attitude that a lot of engineers have.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a lot of the best engineers in the world are down there trying to, you know, come up with ways to solve this problem.
Right.
And usually you have, for instance, when I went down to cover the Iktok spill, they had helicopter flights going out about every half hour, and you just put your name on a list, and they'd take you out, so you could take photographs and see what was going on.
Right.
So it's a similar kind of situation, and I do think that British Petroleum so far has acted quite well in trying to be open about this, and it's obviously in their best interest to to work with the press as much as possible,
right,
so that people do get the full story.
Right, because I guess in oil spills in the past that they've only come to, you know, take responsibility and answer questions and all that weeks after, and then it just is way, way worse for them.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Nip it in the bud, I guess, is the idea.
Exactly.
Yeah. And on the piece that you're writing, what are you being asked to write about specifically? Is it from the sea life standpoint, or is it more just about the situation?
Actually, what I'm doing, as you know, most of my writing has been science writing.
Right.
And I've been writing about science and the environment and that sort of thing. This past summer, I put my back out, and I couldn't do my regular science writing, so I started writing some kids' books.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all based on...
Which, by the way, I've been telling you to do since I was about 5 years old, because you're a great storyteller.
Well, I guess you were right.
I can't imagine this is going to be a children's book, is it?
Well, it actually is.
Really?
The characters that I've developed, mm-hmm, are a girl who she learns how to ride a bull.
Okay.
And then they go off on adventures, and they're sort of becoming environmental warriors.
This is awesome.
So they've been invited down to New Orleans to look at the situation and help, clean up some of the birds and everything like that.
You need to do it like a comic strip, like Tintin.
Well, it will have illustrations.
I love it. Who's illustrating it?
I have a number of illustrators. I've done three of these books so far, and I have different illustrators for each one. And, of course, Christina has illustrated the first one.
My stepmom.
Exactly.
And would you... I mean, is it a nice transition to be, you know, not called in to do this sort of the nitty gritty scientific parts of it? I mean, because, usually you get called in to be the horseshoe crab expert. Is it nice to do something a little more broad, I guess, or layman?
It's fun because I can have a lot more fun with it. Mm-hmm. Even. The hard part with this one is that it's ultimately a fairly sad story.
Right.
But I do try to sort of bring out the adventure. And you know, people react very well in situations like that.
Sure.
So I'm trying to bring out some of those interactions between people and people operating under stress and that sort of thing. So I'm hoping to have some humor in the story as well.
Well, and I guess the hopeful light, the good spin you can put on it, is that to hit the next generation with a lesson is almost more important than hitting, you know, there's only so much, you know, the scientists can do now, but maybe the kids who grow up in after this.
Yeah, I almost give up on my generation.
Right.
I know, for instance, I've been looking at people who have houses on Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been washing away because of sea level rise.
Sure.
And even when their house is washing away, you know, they'll be adamant that there's no such thing as sea level rise and we don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
So I pretty much, I'm throwing up my hands and just saying, well, okay, I'll start talking to your kids.
People are stubborn right down. You're saying they're so stubborn that even when their house is floating away, they still won't admit.
Absolutely.
The problem. Yeah,
right.
that is the main. And I think, I don't know if that's an American problem or if that's just a world problem.
I think it's a human problem.
It's a human problem.
And that's, you know, that's that's the problem with oil, too.
Right.
We love to drive our cars.
Creatures of habit.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, you know, if you take someone's place at the bar and suddenly they can't sit in their seat, they freak out.
Yeah.
It's like, go sit at the next seat, just one seat down. No. Can't go there. I think that explains it. Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show, and it's been way overdue. I always forget that I have experts in my own family to call on in these situations.
Well, it was great fun, and I love your theme music.
Oh, thank you. All right, I'll talk to you after the show. Thanks a lot.
Okay, good luck.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Staying alive, here to survive in a global Mexico. You might call